So I'm just going to start. Emil Boshin, his collection has been at the museum since I started in around 2012 as an intern. And when I started there, it was kind of, they weren't actually organized well or even housed well. They were just stuffed into shoe boxes, and just, there were like 25 boxes, varying sizes, shoe boxes, cigarette boxes, and his photos were just shoved in there as tightly as possible. And it wasn't until 2015 that we ended up getting a grant from the NHPRC, that's National Historic Publications and Records Commission, and that allowed us to hire a project archivist, and this was one of the collections that she ended up rehousing and doing a finding aid for. And so now it looks like this. I don't have pictures of it before it was organized, but this is kind of to give you an idea of just how big his collection is. These are all negatives. Every envelope has about between 5 to 20 negatives. I actually was not able to go through these just because it's time consuming. It's just too time consuming. And there are also boxes of photographs like this. And we didn't have time to house each individual photograph. So right now they're just wrapped in acid-free tissue paper. So it'll prevent them from deteriorating further. But they do need to be housed better when we do have time and resources. And so there's about, so if you can see here, like there are maybe about like 100 photographs in each packet, and there's maybe about 10 to 15 packets in each box, and we've housed them by year. And the shelves are like this. We have about 3 shelves, so it's this and 2 more, just to give you an idea of how many actual photographs we have of his. And so basically, the collection, as I mentioned, when I got to the museum, it was not housed well, and there wasn't any corresponding paperwork. And so with the museum, the way it goes now, we ask people to sign a deed of gift, and so we maintain a chain of custody of the artifact, just so we know if they give us permission to use it, and if we have permission, where we can go if we need to find out more information. But when this came to the museum, probably around 1982, it was at the very beginning of the museum, which started in 1980. So, or actually it wasn't 82, it came in like probably 1990. And so there was no paperwork. I don't think they thought to find paperwork. And so it was a big issue of, we couldn't use it at all because we didn't know who owned it. And we didn't want to put it online and make it available to researchers and then have somebody come and be like, I own these photographs, you have to take them down, you can't use them, we're going to sue you, and that kind of thing. And so I ended up trying to figure out where this whole thing came from. And it started out with trying to find paperwork that we had. And some paperwork had Betty Lee Sung as a possible donor. And we went to talk to her, and her memory was really fuzzy, but the story she told about it was that she saw Emil throwing out these photographs in the street, and she picked them up and bought them there. And that was kind of, it was an iffy story. And so we kept looking around, and I called one of the older staff members, Fei Chu Matsuda, and she kind of said that it could have been donated by Mei Wong, who was an actress in Flower Drum Song, and she was really active in the Chinatown community. And she said that it could have been from her. And so eventually, it was really hard getting in contact with her, but eventually after talking to Mei Wong, she gave us a story about how she, when Emil died in 1990, she went to his apartment, which was in a Confucius Plaza. And his relatives were cleaning it out, and they were throwing out a lot of things, so they had to clean out the apartment. And she saw all these photographs, and she asked her relatives if she could take them. And then she took them, and she went to Charlie Lai, who's one of the founders of MoCA. And at the time, he was, I believe, executive director. And she asked if they wanted them. And he said he didn't have space for them now. And so she stored them in the public school where she worked. And then when they needed the space, she moved them to a friend's basement. And then eventually, MoCA did take them. And that was her story. And based on everything that she's told me and that I kind of found out through the collection, I think that's the most plausible way that the photographs got to MoCA, but it's still not 100% confirmed because there's really no way to do it. But let's see. Okay, so I'm going to go on to the next slide. Okay, and so this is a crudely put together family tree. I did it in Microsoft Word. And so this is basically his whole family tree. Originally, when I first started, I only had his mother, father, his 2 brothers, and Emil. But then after talking to some of his relatives, the family tree got bigger, and this is what I believe his family tree is now. And so the people that that I was able to find through his letters and materials in his collection were his nephew Franklin, and his niece Adeline, and her daughter Jocelyn. And they were kind of the backbone for most of the research that I was able to do on his collection. And so this is actually an interesting story. Franklin was actually doing family research on his own family. And so he was able to obtain a census from 1915, which is where I got most of the birth dates from, for all of his family. But on the census, his sister wasn't there, interestingly, and I don't know why. But the story with Franklin is that his father, Meyer, he owned a pharmacy with one of his other siblings. And the pharmacy started doing badly, and one of his siblings bought him out. And then the pharmacy started profiting again. And Meyer always thought that his family kind of screwed him over, and he kind of left the family himself. And so Franklin doesn't really know too much about the rest of his family. But Emil was born in 1912. He's the youngest of all the Boeschen children. And he was born in Brooklyn. He didn't attend college. Let's see. According to Adeline, he got his first camera at around 16 or 17, and he always kind of loved photography after that. And so in the collection, there's actually a record that Emil's brother, Louis, who was in the military, recorded and sent back to his mother. So it was probably in the 1930s or 40s. And so we were able to digitize it. So if you can actually just click on this thing here.
Hello, Mom. I know this is your favorite song, so I stopped in at the Chicago Servicemen Center and thought I'd send it to you on a record. Everything is going along fine. There's nothing for you to worry about. God bless you all, and I'm sending my love to everybody.
Acting discreetly, you've left me completely at sea. It's so distressing, you're keeping me guessing this way.
Song. And there's a song on side B. And I don't know if he's actually the one singing it, but it could be. If I can get it to play later on, you guys can hear it. And so this is actually some of the negatives in Emil's collection, and this is his family, actually. So if you actually look, his father is here. It's not clear. I've tried to brighten up the negative as best I could, but this is his father right here, right? And let's see. His sister is right here. This is his sister, Lillian, his oldest sister, if you can see at all. And that's his brother-in-law. And that's his niece, Adeline. And that's her husband. And so that's Adeline and her husband. And so she's the one that kind of remembered a lot of stuff, and she was the one that I corresponded with through emails to learn about Emil's family. And so that's obviously not a picture of, obviously it's not Emil, but Emil, his first job was giving out cigarettes to people to try and get them to start smoking. And that was his first job. And in his collection, interestingly enough, there's actually a picture he took in Chinatown of a cigarette sample person. And so this was a practice that went on till like the 80s, when people started suing tobacco companies because they said as children they gave them cigarettes and they started smoking, and that's when it stopped. And these are just his two lighters, and they have his initials on it, EVB and EB. And so he was a smoker, I guess. Okay, and so from there, his first job that we kind of have evidence of was when he was about 37. He wrote a lot of articles for these two comedy trade magazines, Humor Business and Comedy World. And he wrote, and they seemed to just be like satire articles that he wrote for these magazines. He also wrote two pieces for The New Yorker. I couldn't get them because I don't have a New Yorker subscription, so I can't look at them online. So there's no way for me to print them out. But if you're interested, one was on January 3rd, 1948, and the other one was September 29th, 1951. And the article 1951 was actually about a Chinese harmonica virtuoso named Chamber Huang. And apparently he has he makes harmonicas now, or before he died, he was a harmonica maker too. And so if you guys want to look up those articles, if anyone has a New Yorker subscription, you can email them to me too. I'd like to see them. And so actually in his collection, he has a lot of scripts that he wrote. They're unmade screenplays. And he also has jokes that he wrote. And so I photocopied one of the pages, and I'll just read you some of his jokes. So laugh at the appropriate times if you feel like it. They're written kind of like the school like joke books, where it's like one person says this, second person says this. So I'll just read you a couple. So he titled this thing Down Memory Lane. And so, let's see. So the one that I actually like is, someone goes, why don't you get married? And person two goes, what? And waste all my education? Don't you know I went 4 years to college studying for a bachelor's degree? And then, let's see. And there's also, let's see. What would you say if I asked you to marry me? Person two goes, nothing. I can't talk and laugh at the same time. And so I'll stop there. But there's a lot more, and you guys can decide if they're actually funny or not. But maybe that's why he didn't go into comedy. But okay, so next slide. So in the 1950s, he met this other Polish Jewish. His parents were from Poland, and he met Waldo Mayo, who was also Polish Jewish. And Waldo Mayo, he was a famous violinist when he was a child, and his sister was Lucille Lortel, who was a famous Broadway actress. And after Waldo Mayo died, his sister started a... what did she start? She started a competition in his honor where the winner would be a young violinist and he'd do a solo during a concert for the senior orchestra at Carnegie Hall. And it ran... I don't know if it's still running, but it definitely ran in 2015. And so this is actually a photo of Emil when he was at the agency. He's not actually in jail or anything. It seems like... people in the agency just kind of took it as a joke because there are other people from the agency that have the same like tag around their neck. This is actually just Emil. It seems like a publicity shot. I think she was Miss Canada in 1951, of Ruth Carrier. And so there's actually like, I found a YouTube video of Waldo Mayo playing violin. You don't actually see him, but it's a record, but we won't play it just because... Unless you want to, you guys want to hear it, Waldo Mayo, or? Well, yeah. Well, okay. Just play a little bit of it. And so that's Waldo Mayo playing. And so this was actually a photo that Emil took of Waldo Mayo. It was in his contact sheets. And I think the red marker were the ones he wanted to print. And so those would be the photos that he'd end up printing at some point. And so while he was working at Waldo Mayo's PR agency, he worked with this mentalist named Chan Canasta, who he did card tricks. So he would be like one of those magicians that went, pick a card, I'll guess your card. But he would do it on a bigger scale. So he'd have people pick like maybe 5 cards at a time, and then another person pick like 10 more, and he'd try and name all 15 cards. And so Emil and him met while they were at the PR agency, and then this is one of the photos that Emil took of him at one of the TV shows. He was on like BBC. He was a pretty well-known, apparently, at the time. And so the reason he's important is a lot of the information came from correspondences between him and Emil. They were friends from when they met in around the 60s all the way through to the 70s and 80s. And so Emil and him wrote back and forth. There's a lot of letters between them. And so these are actually the correspondences between them. The top row is Chan Canasta's letters to Emil, and the bottom's Emil to Chan Canasta. So I don't know why Emil kept copies of his own letters, but he did, which is good. Because usually with letter collections, it's always one-sided, and it's hard to kind of guess what they're responding to. And that's a problem we have with a lot of letter collections in Mocha's collection. It's only one-sided. But, yeah, these are all the letters. The beginning ones are from 62, I believe, and these are from, like, 78. Let's see. And so... At Waldo Mayo, Emil didn't seem like he did too many publicity campaigns. He kind of took some photos for TV shows. And this seems to be one of the only campaigns that he actually ran. It was for Miss Dairy Queen competition. And he photographed a lot of the competitors and wrote like little bios about them. And so this is the one he did for Patty Stone. Can you guys read it, or is it too small? Okay, so I'll try and read it to you. It says, Patty Stone of 417 Liberty Way, Newport, Pennsylvania, hoping to win the state final, will compete with 3,500 teenagers from all over the nation for the title of Miss Dairy Queen Teenager, which is being judged on the basis of the girl who best represents the sparkling, refreshing, and healthy beauty of the modern American teenager. Patty chose Times Square with that tremendous sign over her shoulder as a place to sign her contest entry blank, since the judges at the national contest finals in October will be Kirk Douglas, Janet Leigh, Tony Curtis, and Ernest
Borgnine.
Yeah. And so this is Times Square.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in 1960, he was still working with Waldo Mayo, but he went off and did his own PR agency. He opened Emil Boshin and Associates. And the interesting thing was, when I talked to his niece Adeline about him opening his own business, she said he never did because he never had money. But we have like incorporation documents where him and a few other people started this agency. And so one of the first things he was responsible for was actually doing PR for the Swiss Skyride at the World's Fair. And during that whole campaign, his idea was that he would take a different girl from a different pavilion, and each week or month would feature her as Miss Swiss Skyride. And his idea was that it would promote their pavilion as well as the Swiss Skyride. And so he ended up doing that, and he did it for Spain, Sweden, and Taiwan. And he actually got them on Nightlife on ABC. And so they got to talk about their own pavilion, and it also promoted Swiss Skyride. Let's see. Okay, and so now this is where how he gets to Chinatown, or this is the story about how he gets involved with Chinatown. So Stephen Chang was an actor in World of Susie Wong in 1959, which actually I think starred William Shatner too. And so he worked with William Shatner. And at some point in the 70s, he started this band called Stephen Chang and the Dragon Seeds. They performed at MoMA on August 19th, 1971. And he was one of Emil's clients. And so Emil was trying to promote Stephen Chang. And he actually kept pitching. There were a lot of letters of him pitching this variety show starring Stephen Chang to all these networks. And they always send back no thanks or we don't have time. And so it was during this time that he went to Chinatown a lot, because I think Stephen was from Chinatown. And so when he went to Chinatown, one of Stephen's friends was Mei Wong, who was also a Broadway actress in Flower Drum Song. And when I talked to her, she said she didn't like Emil when he first met him, because he was really pushy. He had like that really, like what you'd expect of someone in PR or marketing. Like, he was really brash, and she didn't like him. But she said he kept going to Chinatown, and they eventually became friends. And so in 1971, Mei Wong was working for CPC, which was the Chinatown Planning Council, and they were doing a Miss Chinatown pageant. And so if you can see here, it's tiny. She's the chairperson. She's the chairperson, and actually Stephen Chang is here as as a splendid something. But she told Emil about this pageant, and he took it upon himself to tell all the news outlets like ABC, NBC, CBS, and he told them about this competition. And according to her, they showed up the day of to try and cover it. And Mei Wong actually said she was busy preparing all the girls and setting everything up, that she actually sent them away, so they didn't take any footage or anything. And she said in hindsight that was a really big mistake on her part because she was young. And that's kind of how he got involved in Chinatown. That's his first foray there. And so the next bit is from a letter he actually wrote to Chan Canast in like 1976. And he kind of tries to explain how he got to Chinatown. Or how he got involved in Chinatown. And so if you can't really see it, but I'll read you the highlighted part. He goes, this is his letter to Chan Canast dated May 4th, 1976. And he goes, I got involved with Chinatown when the theater owner asked me to get some publicity for an unknown actor in a movie, Fist of Fury, the Chinese version. I did such a good job that it started the avalanche of kung fu movies in the U.S. As usual, I didn't connect with the right money crowd. People still think I cleaned up with my publicity campaign for Bruce Lee. The theater owner also owned this paper, and that is how I'm here. Drop me a note at this address. Best wishes. Hope to see you soon. And so the owner owned the Pagoda Theater. His name is Lucas Liang. There's a lot of paperwork with his name on it, but I wasn't able to find a picture of him. But this picture is actually from Poi Gum Lee's collection, who's the architect who designed Pagoda Theater. The collection is actually at MoCA. I'm guessing that Lucas Liang is in this picture somewhere. He might even be one of these people, but there's no other frame of reference to confirm or anything like that. But so already you kind of see, like, Emil, he likes to, like, embellish things. He claims he was the one that brought kung fu movies to the U.S., things like that, so he's always doing PR. And so this is actually the paperwork from the PR campaign. So if that's if his claim is to be believed, he spent $209 to make the greatest publicity campaign of all time, apparently. And so this is actually a letter he wrote to the New York Post editor, because he wrote to them and they wouldn't come to the screening to review Fist of Fury, and he actually starts going, why aren't you, let me just read you the letter. So he goes, why should Chinese Americans from 100 Mile, okay, so he goes, why should black films, Italian, Swedish, Japanese, German, or indie films be more important than Chinese films? Why should Chinese Americans from 100 mile radius come into New York Chinatown to see a film from their home country? Why should Fist of Fury outgrow Sound of Music in Hong Kong, making its star the greatest in Hong Kong history? Why should this film be a blockbuster in Southeast Asia? Is it true that all Chinese Americans are concentrated in a few cities in the U.S.? The Chinese have been here since 1870. How many have passed over the line? We hope that you can review this film so that your readers will know more about his next door Chinese American neighbor. And I don't think the guy actually showed up at all. The pagoda was
Esther and Bowery.
Yeah.
Thank you. No.
No, it was on
It was on Catherine and right by East Broadway.
It was Allen.
Yeah.
Okay.
East
it was like
Catherine Street.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm talking about the
ghost
shadow.
Oh, good.
So let me keep going. Let's see. And so this was actually this is the China Post office. This is a photo he took in 1977, so it's later on. But this was his business card from the China Post. And the thing is, in English it says Advertising Public Relations, but in Chinese he actually puts his title as reporter and interviewer. So I don't know if there was something that they wanted him to do, or because he didn't speak Chinese, so they translated it for him. And I don't know if they chose that to make him more reputable or something along those lines. But... And the last, it's just his last name. It's not his first name. And so this is kind of how China Post tried to evolve over the years. When Emil first started, he took photo spreads for this entertainment section that was published with China Post. And then he ended up taking pictures for China Post in their actual paper. And then as the times went on, there's a lot of paperwork where the readership declines over the years. And around like 84, he starts trying to change up who they advertise to, and so there's advertisements to like Americans being like, do you want to advertise the Chinese, who are the next biggest consumer, advertise in our paper. And you can see in 85 articles start to appear in English, and so they try and cater to English speaking Chinese. And then in 86 they changed the name of the paper, and 86 was the last year they published, and this might actually be the last issue they published. It's the last issue we have in the collection. So it's from August 30th, 1986. And so this is another one of his letters he wrote to Chan Canast, actually. And so Chinatown's kind of an insular community. They don't like outsiders. You know, they have a lot of, like, it's hard to get anyone to trust you. And so in his letter to Chan Canast, he actually explains, like, how he got the Chinatown community to trust him. And so he writes, they think I'm part Chinese. I tell them I was Chinese. I tell them I was born in Kaifeng so they can understand why a Jew is helping the Chinese. Kaifeng was the capital of China in the 11th century when it had a large Jewish colony. The Jews have been there since then. I'm now connected with a Chinese language newspaper, the China Post in New York's Chinatown, doing public relations work for them and eventually trying to get advertising. Since I have become famous in the Chinese community for getting publicity for their theatrical activities, I've been getting requests from former superstar movie actresses to help them get a foothold in America. And so just to give you an idea of where Kaifeng is, it's here. Beijing is up here, Shanghai's up here, and Hong Kong somewhere down here. But Kaifeng is here. And so I'm going to keep going. And so this was a photo spread he did in 1973, which might have been the first one he ever did for the paper. And so it's, you can see this is just a parade in Chinatown. And these, he actually, these were things he cut out of different brochures about Lunar New Year, and he just put them together. And in his collection, you actually see them with the glue on the back on paper. And so the next thing he did in 73 when he first started was he went to, he actually learned about Marcy Louie from Mae Wong because she was friends with Marcy Louie's parents and Marcy stayed with her. But Marcy Louie at the time was the only Chinese American ranked tennis player. She was ranked 14 and she played in the US Open. And so he went to the US Open in Forest Hills to photograph her. And so after he took the photos, he he actually wrote a letter to her father in California, and he actually told he asked him for a lot of information like her name and stuff, and he was saying that he wanted to start a section in the China Post with a series of prominent young American Chinese. And so after this, they sort of became friends. They exchanged letters. He followed her all the way through until she stopped playing tennis. And so the next picture is, this is actually Forest Hill Stadium in 1976. So I think it's really cool. Because I've only ever seen it dilapidated and just a mess. And it's really interesting to see it like that. But this is 1977, and that's actually Marcy's sister, Maureen, who played tennis too. And he ended up covering both of them. He photographed both of them. And there are a lot of letters where they write to him, like birthday cards and things like that. And they always ask him for prints, and he always sends them prints, and he also gives like advice on how to play on like what he sees as like tells from the other tennis players of what they're doing, and they were friends for a really long time. And I spoke to Marcy, and she was saying that so Emil, you already know he kind of likes to embellish things. She said she remembers a story that he told her when they first met that his father discovered Neil Diamond, which is completely not true as far as any documentation I could find. But this is the story he ended up writing about Marcy. And so I'll just read you the first paragraph. He writes, "This young lady may probably become the world champion tennis player in 5 years. 5'5", 111 pounds, San Francisco born, 20-year-old Marceline Louie is the only ranking American Chinese tennis player today, man or woman, and is the first American Chinese tennis player to play in the snobbish Forest Hill Stadium in the annual United States lawn tennis tournament matches." And so he goes on to kind of talk about her. And so the next thing he does in 1973 is actually, this was when Connie Chung was first getting into the national spotlight, and so he wrote to a news agency to try and get some pictures, some information about her, and kind of do a piece on her. And he eventually does, and that's the piece he put together. And he actually sent this to her, and they corresponded for a while. So there's actually, that's a Christmas card she sent to him. And so I'll read you the letter he wrote that this is in response to. So the letter he writes is dated December 14th, 1973. And he writes, I'll just skip some of it. So he goes, "Dear Connie Chung, the editors like this photo. Now she looks like a very beautiful Chinese girl with that hair, with this hairstyle. The other way, she looks just like any other very pretty girl. The China Post thinks I got the entire interview by phone. I left it that way. Sounds more romantic. The fellow who translated the story is Kung Swa Hu. Ooh, I can't read his name. professor of journalism in Taiwan and 6 years head of the Paris desk of the Central Daily News of Taiwan. He's great on literature translations, but rough on dialogue colloquialisms, like most Chinese. I don't speak Chinese because my accent is liable to offend the person I'm speaking to. However, everyone at the shop practices their English on me. Sometimes it is difficult to understand them, but I've come up with a solution. Most erudite and literate Chinese people who mispronounce English words read more than they converse. Hence, their pronunciation can be a motley mixture of their own invention and those of two Chinese friends. How do you spell that word has now become a popular phrase around the shop. Since the series began, I have become a big man around Mott Street. Some readers were disappointed when I told them I only spoke to you on the phone. Everyone seems to know someone who saw you in person, and she is much prettier than her pictures in the paper. So now I tell them I have interviewed you in person, and their faces light up Mott Street. Since this issue came out, I got 3 calls from men wanting to marry you. I told them to contact you at CBS in Washington. I jokingly referred to one of them that your picture in the China Post is now on sale in a poster size on Mott Street. Half an hour later, he calls back and said he couldn't find it, which gives me an idea. If Bruce Lee's picture can sell, why can't yours? One fellow at the paper says, you write such nice things about her. Must be your daughter. She's not my daughter. She's my wife. No. Nobody writes such nice things about his wife. Why can't she be my wife? Because you're too old. What do you mean, too old? Age is a state of mind. Mine got nothing to do with marriage. How about for centuries, the Chinese men have many wives and some were nearly half their age. Suppose I were an emperor. Everyone then stopped work, got into a huddle, and discussed this hypothetical question. Occasional glances by each one were thrown at me. Finally, we all say, okay, if you were an emperor, you make a good emperor, but you're not an emperor. You're only a reporter, so we must look for a younger man for her. There's an ending here, and I regret to mention it. I have yet to see you on television. I keep getting Walter Cronkite, and I listen carefully. He might mispronounce your name. I've picked up a new habit. Thank you, and I hope you like my New Year's card. And so her response to him, she goes, thanks for your letter and the copies of the newspaper. Tell those nice Chinese boys, this nice Chinese girl is not interested in getting married yet. Getting married, not yet at least. And as for the picture, as for the poster,
I have already
had
one put together
with my head on Raquel Welch's body. Happy holidays to a reporter disguised as an emperor or vice versa. Warm regards, Connie Chung. And so that's that. And so in 1974, he actually starts this initiative to celebrate Chinese Lantern Festival Day for New York City public school children, because he said there's no national holidays to honor the Chinese. And so he wrote these press releases to all the schools to try and get the mayor to do this. And the wording in the press releases are kind of weird. And so I printed one up, and I'll read you a little bit of it. One of them goes, one of the greatest tragedies in America today is child abuse. One purpose of the February 6th celebration is to demonstrate to those parents in America who encourage child abuse a facet of Chinese culture. The expression of love given to a child is always returned a thousandfold. The American Chinese children are marching onto City Hall to demonstrate their love for humanity and to give thanks to their parents for being born into the world of the future. So I guess he's saying Chinese culture promotes child abuse, and this is to kind of show that they don't. It's a really weird press release. And so this was actually the photos from that first event. So the kids would march with lanterns from the public schools to City Hall and present the mayor at the time, Abraham Beam, with the lanterns. And he actually issued this proclamation. There's actually one over here. It looks like the original one would look like this. But in Emile's collection, he only has a photocopy of it. And basically, it just kind of proclaims that day to be Chinese Lantern Festival. And the festival ran until like around 1980 when he got a letter from one of the school's principals that said, no one's participating anymore. It's hard to get politicians to show up. Schools don't want to do it. So there's got to be a better way to honor Chinese culture. Let's sit down with PTA and the principals and let's talk about it and figure something else out. I don't think he ever did, because at that point he was pretty old. But so it ran from 74 to 80. And since in 1974, he actually took pictures of Muhammad Ali's visit to Chinatown, which is something I thought was really cool. And so this is actually CCBA president at the time, M.B. Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Muhammad Ali. And so you just kind of look at those. And then he also photographed the Peter Yu protests, which is it's a police brutality case. So it's kind of like what's going on now. Back then, there was a lot of gang violence, so the police in Chinatown would stop and frisk Chinese kids. And so there was one of them that was being beaten by the cops after they frisked him. He was around like 15. And Peter Yu was 27. He was an engineer. He tried to stop them. And when he tried to stop them, they beat him, arrested him for resisting arrest, and then brought him to the precinct, strip searched him, and beat him again. And so this was the protest against that whole case. And so if you take a look, they actually marched to the precinct. Well, the sign says, it says, the Chinese protest, discrimination. I can't see it. We Chinese protest discrimination and something. But these are those photos from that protest. And so now I'm just going to kind of go through the photos by year, just to kind of give you an idea of the kind of things he photographed for the paper. And so this is actually a worker standing in front of a building site with signs that say the workers here aren't, they're not part of the New York Building Trades Council, so they're kind of scabs. And the next photo is a Chinese opera. They're just opera actors getting ready. And so this is a woman actually making fake hair, it looks like. And this one is it's Democratic Congressman James Murphy, and he's trying to get the Chinese American community to register to vote in the upcoming election. And so 1977, I don't know how many of you guys have been wandering around Chinatown a lot, but this over here is when they were building that post office on Doyer Street, the one that's there now. And so this is during the construction of that. This is a fundraiser at Chatham Square Library. And this is a workers' protest. I thought it'd be a little bigger. Sorry. And this is the dedication ceremony for the post office. So if you could just imagine that narrow street, all those people there, it's really interesting. And Confucius Plaza, that statue that's there, I don't think they put it in when they built the building. This, they put it in like around 77, and this was the commemoration ceremony of the statue being put in, or after it got put in. And also in 1977, Chinatown had a mini marathon. Mm-hmm. And I tried to go online and look up more information on it. There's nothing on it. So I don't know much about it, but it looks like they closed off the bridge because there's nobody else on the bridge. And so... Also, Emil's photos, some of them have these little tags attached to them on the back that describe the photo. And a lot of the photos on the back, they have tape marks but no description paper. And I think they might have gotten lost from being moved around so much, and just because the tape just falls off right when you touch it. And so this one says, Police Inspector of Manhattan, South District, congratulates China's most famous marathon runner, 67-year-old Chan Ling Wong. Both ran the Chinatown Mini Marathon race Sunday, August 28th. I tried to look up Chan Ling Wong. Nothing comes up. So I don't think he was the most famous Chinese marathon runner. I think it was just another one of his... Yeah. But and in 1977, also, the it was Transfiguration Church's 150th anniversary, and Cardinal Cook came down from St. Patrick's Cathedral, yeah. And he visited Chinatown, and Emil took a lot of photos of him and did a photo spread. And he ended up mailing the photos to the Cardinal, and the Cardinal actually wrote him back thanking him for the photos and saying he's going to come back down to Chinatown again. And so now we're on to 78. And so 78, this is just the snow scene. Well, I guess sanitation didn't really shovel at all then. These are just some tourists in Chinatown. Let me see, I wrote down some notes. This is actually Mei Hua Chow Mein Company. And this was actually a location that Mocha ended up salvaging in the 80s. So when they closed down completely, Mocha actually went there and took things from there to put into the archives. And we actually have the awning and the window. And so I'll show it to you next slide. But this is actually Jack Chen, who was one of the co-founders of Mocha. And this was one of the first exhibitions he did that would end up eventually leading to Mocha's formation. And this was Chinese in America, Images of a Neglected Past. And so this is him talking to two women about it. And this was for Basement Workshop. This was before Mocha existed. The next one's actually it's a protest by senior citizens for 115 Christie Street. And it was a building that the city built for the senior center, but two senior centers wanted it. They were CPC Senior Center and Hamilton Madison Golden Age Club. And since the city couldn't decide who would get it, they just left the building empty for 2 years. And so they were just saying, just let one of us have it for now, and they were protesting that whole thing. And the next picture is actually Chinatown Ice Cream Factory. I think this is probably the year it opened, 1978, but on the awning it says since 1978, but I was looking online and there are articles and interviews where supposedly they opened in 77 and the awning's wrong, but but this is this is the ice cream factory. Chinese ice cream, I think that means Chinese ice cream flavors like sesame, green tea, otherwise I don't know what they're talking about. And so the next slide is actually, this is the awning that you saw in the picture and this and the glass sign. And so you could tell I kind of like crudely cut them together because it's too big. But we took it, and two of the families actually that co-owned the noodle company came to the museum to kind of try and do some research because they thought they knew we had some stuff on their family, and they've donated more stuff to the collection. So, in 79, we have these kids at the phone booth on Bayard Street, and you can see the Chinese pagoda tops. I don't think there are any more left. Mocha has one in the collection, but we don't have the original booth. But we just put it on top of an old Bell South booth and just pretend it's original. This is the corner of Canal and Center Street in 79. It's really different now.
Yeah.
This was a protest for Vietnam refugees. And so this was a time when Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam War, I think. And these were... when the UN was discussing the issue. And if you look, the kid actually has a sign that says, "Kill the second Hitler," referring to probably Ho Chi Minh. And it's interesting, I don't think the kids actually know what the signs mean, but
yeah,
they're holding them. This is the Dalai Lama's visit to St. Patrick's Cathedral. The next photo is actually really interesting. It's the architect that built the playground for in Columbus Park, and she's talking to somebody about her plan for the playground and the cost and when it'll be completed. And the next photo is the leaders of Chinatown going to see the marching band from the New York Chinese School perform for their 70th anniversary. And so now we're on 1980. The Carvel is actually where the Haagen-Dazs is now. So it used to be a Carvel before Haagen-Dazs took it over. This is Mott Street. You can see Chinatown Fair. The arcade's still there. This photo, it wasn't taken by Emil, obviously, but he's here, and Betty Lee Sung is here. So they were friends. This one's pretty interesting. It's a firefighter. He wrote, "This man has the honor of being the only Chinese firefighter in the New York City force of 11,500 firefighters, and just as his mother-in-law is Miss dot 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 dot." And so I don't know if he was going to fill that in later or what he was going to do, but I don't know if it's true or not. I feel like it's kind of another one of those facts that he kind of just pushed because it's 1980. This is a volleyball tournament. I just thought this was actually a nice looking photo. It looked pretty. And this is a pastry shop. And so, 81, this is just a street scene. Please come. This is Charlie Chin at the Asian Pacific Heritage Festival. Charlie Chin was part of Yellow Pearl music group, and he was part of the Asian American movement. This picture's interesting. It's a woman at a cart with a Chinese symbol for family or home, and she's just stir-frying. I don't know if it's... she's selling it or what she's doing, but this looks like it's like around Midtown too. This is Chinatown YMCA. This is a girl holding a Chinatown YMCA balloon. These are vendors on Canal Street. And this is just a woman in the park. It just looks like she's in jail. So I thought it was interesting. And so he also did a photo spread about Astor Court, which is that Chinese garden that the Met opened. And they opened it in 81. And he just did a photo spread talking about it. And it still looks the same now. interestingly. And I think the next one's actually gang violence. If you're averse to like dead bodies, just look the other way. And so in the 80s, I talked about gang violence in Chinatown with all the tongs, ghost shadows. This was probably a result of gang violence at Confucius Plaza. You can see. I thought it was an interesting series of photos that he took. You see that the body, police show up, cover the body. There's two of them. They wheel them away. And then just somebody just comes out with a hose and just hoses off the blood. And I guess people just go about their day. And it's hard because I a lot of people come to Mocha asking about like gangs in Chinatown, and it's a topic that like the members don't want to talk about because they're still afraid of repercussions, and there's just not a lot of documentation of that time, and so it's interesting to see actually some photos of that type of violence, and how it just it looks like it happened during the day too. It's just like it's really brazen and just no regard. So now we're in 1982. He actually took some pictures of the filming of Big Bird Goes to China. It came out in 1983, but if you haven't seen it, it starts out in Chinatown in New York. And so he took some pictures of the filming. This is Columbus Park, and so that's the pavilion before it got dilapidated. And you can, if you can see, there's a mural painted here on it. It's a Chinatown outdoor bazaar. So I guess it was like a flea market. And then there was also the protest for the building of the jail in Chinatown. This thing says, one of them says, we need education, not prisons. And I think because of the protest, they deferred the decision to build the prison. But I think ultimately they ended up building it. And it's there. And so it didn't really. And so the next one is 1983. And so I chose this picture. It's a storefront. And so Mei Wong was saying that Emile had a real eye for things that were interesting photographs. And one thing he was interested in photographing was storefronts. Because when he was doing his photographing, he kind of saw that Chinatown was changing and a lot of storefronts were disappearing. And so he would photograph a lot of the storefronts. There's actually a lot more storefronts to like China Lane and things like that, like old restaurants. And this is one I chose because Shavy Lee was kind of interesting. He was, in the 1940s, he was considered the mayor of Chinatown. He kind of sponsored like a basketball team. He went to a lot of events. He was kind of the face of Chinatown during those years. And this is his restaurant and his office. This is a snowstorm in Chinatown, and it's not plowed at all. And if you look over here, there's actually a lot of cars just like sideways and just all kinds of stuff. This is just a street scene, and this is another street scene of Chinatown Street Fair in September. I don't know why we don't do it anymore. If anyone knows, I'd be interested. The next picture is actually of the New York Chinatown History Project's first show, and that was MoCA's original name when it was founded by Jack and Charlie. They wanted to document Chinatown, and this was their first exhibition. It was called 8-Pound Livelihood. This was before they had a space. And so this was in the New York Public Library on 5th Avenue. And it was an exhibition about Chinese laundrymen in New York and all over the country. And it's now 1984. This is Jesse Jackson and David Dinkins before he becomes mayor. So I think this is him campaigning for his future mayorship. This is the grand opening of Columbus opening house. I think this is where the bathrooms are now, those bathrooms right by the tennis court area. I think that's what this is. This is Emile with Ed Koch. It was taken by the official photographer of the mayor of New York City, Holland Wemple. The photo on the the three photos on the bottom, it looks like it's a protest against the police by children. And I tried to find any information about it, but there wasn't really anything, or I didn't have enough time to dig further. But the sign she's holding, it says, we called the police for help. No one came. The next one says, are you really our friends? And the last one, I think it is, it says, like, where were you when we needed you? And this is right in front of the 5th Precinct. So I don't know what the circumstances for these photos were. But and so this is him in 85. And keep in mind, this is when the paper's not doing well. It's already kind of losing readership, and I think they probably know it's going to close soon. And so this is him. He looks really tired. And this is 85. This is a Lunar New Year parade. He seems to always take pictures of Lunar New Year parades every year. This is International Ladies Garment Workers Union protest because jobs are being sent overseas. And so they're wearing these barrels. And there's also these women just sitting in Columbus Park. This is the nine-man tournament, the nine-man volleyball tournament in Columbus Park. This is a protest against FDIC for raiding Chinese communities. And this is actually where that Starbucks is now on Center Street. And the next one is PS20. They turned it into a garment factory. And so this is before, as they were converting. And so 86, paper's not doing too well, and there's not too many photographs from that time. But one he took is of J. Dean Wong, who was a famous dancer and actress. And the interesting thing is this piece right here, J. Dean's brother actually donated it to the museum. And so we have a piece right here. And this is also Pearl River Mart when it was at Broadway and Canal. And so 1990 is when he dies. And this was actually a letter that his nephew had. I don't know why. It's addressed to Adeline, but his nephew, Franklin, had it. The one who, if you remember, he doesn't talk to his family. He doesn't know. So I don't know how he got the letter in the end. But he had the letter. And this is from Richard Wong, who's Mae Wong's husband. And sent to Adeline. It just encloses a translation and copy of the article on a meal, which appeared in the July 27, 1990 edition of the Chinese United Journal. Best regards, Richard Wong. And so this is the article that appeared, and that's his photo. And I'll just read you the article according to the translation he sent. The article goes, "A dear friend of New York, of the NYC Chinatown, Mr. Emil Boshin, died recently. He will be greatly missed by his friends in this community for his devoted hard work over the 20 years in Chinatown. Mr. Boshin, formerly employed by the New York China Daily, has been with this press for a little over 3 years as photographer and news reporter. Mr. Boshin, of Jewish descent, has been working for the welfare of this community over the past 20 years. He was admitted to the hospital earlier and died on the 23rd of this month at the age of 78. He will not only be missed by his friends and relatives, he will also be remembered by his former colleagues of various Chinatown newspapers. His funeral service was held yesterday at a church in Long Island in accordance with the Jewish tradition. Mr. Boshin joined the Chinatown news media in the 70s. He has acted as a bridge between the Chinese community and the local police department. On May 18, 1976, he wrote a letter to Michael Carter, then the chief of the New York City Police Department, requesting the Chinese male be referred to as M.A., male Asian, rather than M.Y., male yellow, in police records as his race. The department accepted his suggestion, and it was recognized throughout the departments in the city. On July 9th of the same year, it was announced that the Chinese people would be referred to as Orientals. This brought respect and appreciation to the Chinese cultures, all because of one man, Mr. Boshin. During his service, he advocated the rights of social services for the Chinese. Also, he brought attention to the municipal authorities and needs, such as road repairs, maintenance within the Chinatown area. He also provided yearly Chinese New Year celebration news and zodiac changes to the television media, which later became a popular yearly event in the city. He was considered the three most respected Jewish persons in the New York Chinatown. The others were Raber and Cohen." And so then it goes photo of Emil. And Chinese poem written in memory of Mr. Boshin. And the poem goes, "The pale carriage led by white horses took away our famous friend along with our tears. Our memories for him will always be there as the green sea and blue sky." And then there's a letter from Mayor Dinkins to Adeline expressing condolences for his death. And that's the end. And so I just want to thank some people. I want to thank UA for helping me with all of this. I want to thank Lauren Stark, who was the project archivist that NHPRC funded. She kind of housed the collection and made it easy for me to go through. Betty Lee Sung for talking to me initially about everything. Russell Leong of AARI for pushing me to kind of write this piece. Adeline and Jocelyn Kaplan, Emil's niece and grandniece. Franklin Boshin, his nephew, and his wife, May and Richard Wong, Marcy Louie, and of course AARI for letting me talk. And that's it. Thank you. So any questions? Yeah.
What was the history of the China Post?
The China Post, it started, I don't know when it started, but it was owned by the owner of Pagoda Theater, and it was catered to the Chinese American community. I think it circulated at most at 20,000 readership, and then it dipped to like the 10,000s before it closed down. It closed down in 86. It changed names two times, I think. It was China Post, then it became I forget what it's called. But then it ended up as China Voice before it shut down.
So it was always in New York City.
It was always in New York City based, 11 Allen Street, even when the names changed.
And he was like on staff with them?
I think he started out as in some of his letters he referred himself as assistant to the editor, and then he became like PR, and then near the end he was like assistant editor. So I don't know if he gave himself these titles or if they let him do it, but it seemed like he was on staff.
Currently, how many papers are there, Chinese papers in China?
Chinese newspapers currently? I wouldn't have any idea. Any Chinese newspapers?
There's two. There's like at least two or three. And they're like national. I think like the Hong Kong-based and the Taiwan-based papers right around when it was going down, mm-hmm. It was going like national.
I think there are at least 5 or 10 actually.
About 4.
The weekly magazines too. And
that's
a.
Yep.
So since he worked there forever, did his Chinese
ever improve? I don't think so.
No.
There's never any real evidence that he could speak Chinese fluently or even got remotely conversational.
Was he always at a distance then from everything?
It seemed like people, from what his niece said, like she would go and people would know him in Chinatown. They would always say hi to him. But other people I tried to talk to that lived in Chinatown like all their lives, they kind of never, they didn't know him. They saw him around like in passing, but they weren't really friends with him. So I don't know if the crowds he ran in were like different than like the regular Chinatown people, because a lot of them were like Marcy Louis from California. They were all just like, they were all people that I guess would be nationally interesting, like Connie Chung and those types of people.
And he lived in China.
He lived in China. He lived in Confucius Plaza. That's actually interesting. Confucius Plaza, supposedly when they first opened it, it was for Chinese people only. And so you might wonder how he got in there. And this was all, Mei Wong worked for one of the congressmen, and she kind of petitioned to get him an apartment in Confucius Plaza. And so he lived in apartment 30J until he died.
No, but, I knew Neil Bosian. And he was just a fixture in the neighborhood. You would always see him around. He would always be at, you know, any event of any note. And he was a nice guy. But, you know, he was, you know, he liked to embellish stories. But I think he really saw it as his mission to connect Chinatown to, like, a wider world. You know, he would just pop up, and you would see him sometimes eating in the restaurants and stuff like that. But people knew him. I mean, you know, just to see him around.
Yeah. I figured he would stand out. Like, you saw him, he wears a bow tie all the time, and he's just like...
Yeah, he was really old school. I mean, like, in the summer, he would wear the blue seersucker suits.
Oh, really?
You know.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah. I was in a dance group at that time, so he liked to photograph the dancers a lot. You know, and sometimes he would just pop up at a rehearsal, and we always thought that these old girls were running around in leotards. But, you know, he connected us at one point. Like, I mean, we did traditional Chinese dance, and it wasn't very well known outside of the community and stuff like that, but he got a New York Times critic to come review one of our performances, and, you know, so that was... I think it really speaks to what he personally thought his mission was, to try to connect Chinatown and the wider world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think his PR connections from like Waldo Mayo helped him a lot, because he worked with like TV studios to do publicity for their TV shows and things like that. So he knew people.
Yeah.
And he got a lot of rejection letters. Like, there's a lot of people writing back, thank you for suggesting this, we have no time to come cover this. And there are a lot of letters like that he kept.
Yeah.
He has a lot of them.
Did he keep a list of his rejections?
No. He has them all, though, still. Yeah.
I just want to thank you for helping to put this together. I mean, I really enjoyed it because
thank you.
When you go past the memories, like the 80s, 70s, 80s, mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
Yeah, we don't have the photo collection in MoCA. Doesn't have too many photos from that period, because that was before the museum kind of came into existence. It was, like, really in its infancy. It was kind of just an idea that Jack and Charlie probably had. And so there's not a lot of documentation from that time. And it's weird because it doesn't seem that far away, the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, we don't have a museum or anything. So.
And there's not. Yeah.
He must have been really fascinated with our culture and with our way of life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because he focused a lot on, you know, our culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And he
definitely took like publicity shots for like a lot of Chinese girls, because there were a lot of photos in his collection. I didn't put any here, but they're headshots, and on the back they have like their bios, so like name, their hobbies, where they went to school. And I don't know if he was trying to help them with a modeling agency or just kind of just for the paper.
But, well, I mean, his earlier career, like, I didn't know until I saw your presentation, like, Miss Dairy Queen.
Yeah, yeah, Miss Swiss Skyride.
I think that was just part of that whole ethos, and I think as an old newspaper guy or old publicity guy, it's like, oh, yeah, you put the pretty girl in front of the car, and then, you know, yeah. It's that whole thing, that
yeah.
whole cultural in time.
Yeah.
I had a question about that translation at the your last slide, mm-hmm. The translation of the article, when it says he was a friend of the community, mm-hmm. like Irwin Cohen, uh-huh. and this other guy.
Yeah.
And it's that's only the second time I've heard that guy Irwin Cohen's name invoked.
Uh-huh.
And it says he's a lawyer.
He's right? a lawyer, yeah.
So I have a letter in my family's collection where my grandfather had hired this lawyer, Irwin Cohen,
uh-huh.
to help him with, you know, a legal matter. Mm-hmm. And I have a copy of the letter that mm-hmm. Irwin Cohen wrote to the authorities or whatever that... for this case, and it says, my name is Irwin Cohen, I'm a lawyer, and my clientele is largely Chinese American, my office is on like Mulberry Street, and it's on that part of Mulberry Street
mm-hmm.
That is now Columbus Park, the southern end of Columbus Park. So there was a building there, mm-hmm. probably opposite True Light Church,
oh, okay.
and it's demolished now, but that was where his office was. And he says, and I, most of my clientele is Chinese, mm-hmm. and I speak fluent Chinese.
Uh-huh.
So there's, I mean, I'm really curious about this guy, Irwin Cohen, you know, because he shows up.
And Raber, actually, if you look on some of the empty stores, it's still Raber Realty or whatever. So,
uh-huh.
So I think his family still runs this real estate.
Really?
I think so,
Irwin
yeah.
Cohen?
No, Raber, the other one.
The other guy.
The other guy, yeah. The real estate developer.
Yeah.
I think he's still doing real estate in Chinatown, or at least someone, one of his relatives is.
Yeah, but like, I mean, guys like them, like Emil Bosian mm-hmm. and Irwin Cohen, and, you know, they inhabit this space, which is kind of like between the Chinese community and then the broader mainstream
yeah.
community. And they were kind of like the cultural translators and the brokers between the community. And it'd be interesting to do a profile on.
Yeah, I mean, like, as Jews themselves, they understood what it was to be excluded
yeah.
from the mainstream, but because they straddled that sort of strange meta space
yeah.
between whiteness and non-whiteness in America, you know, they were, I think, also, you know, culturally, you know, felt an affinity for Chinese, and, you know, if they could have a career, either as a lawyer or a PR photographer,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was like, okay, whereas, you know, like traditional American culture would be like, no, you're over there, we're over here. So these guys kind of, you know, because of their cultural background, religious background, you know, inhabit that space.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because, like, photojournalists are supposed to be, like, outsiders. They're never supposed to be, like, in the work. You're just supposed to kind of watch. And, like, I wrote a little bit about how he was, like, the ultimate outsider. He's, like, not part of the community because he's not Chinese. And he's a photographer, so he's just kind of there. And there was another photographer that I talked to named Kitty Katz, who actually photographed things while he was there. And she said, like, she saw him but never actually talked to him at all. But they were both just, like, concentrating on photographing Chinatown. And she always said it was nice that there was someone else that was not Chinese that liked the community and was interested in it, took pictures of it. Any other questions? Yeah. Sure.
I have a question about the historical purpose of this newspaper, China Post.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering about the subject of this, the subject of the reader. I mean, the readership. And also the subject of the photographs. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, did they identify themselves more as Chinese or as
the paper?
Chinese American?
I think the paper was probably Chinese American. It focused on mainly Chinese-American issues. I don't think it talked too much about like China politics or anything. Because even the things that Emil started photographing, like he would photograph like Taiwan, Little League World Series type things, and I don't think Emil kind of understood like the dynamic between China and Taiwan or anything like that. I think he just photographed what he thought was interesting and what he thought people might want to see. And I can't read Chinese, so I couldn't really read too many of the articles. But the English ones, they do focus on Chinatown and how Chinatown's like garbage issues and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting that that paper died in 1986 because 1986, for 20 years past 1965, mm-hmm. the integration of Chinese population and the ones that can actually read Chinese are actually increasing. Mm-hmm. But when they get to America, they want to read politically in Chinese, you know, something that represents their point of view. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if you're from Hong Kong, you'll read this. If you're from Taiwan, you'll read that. I mean, I think that China Voice was like, for like the last generation of Chinese immigrants that had come to been here for a long time that still read Chinese, mm-hmm. and by the 80s was like kind of dying, you know, but it was like very specific, mm-hmm. because then all these other papers came over and took their Chinese language, but still in different perspectives.
Because from his obituary, it seems like he worked for another paper after he left China Post in 86.
I think he worked for the United Journal after that.
Yeah, it says New York China Daily.
Oh,
China Daily? Yeah. So we don't have any of those photographs, so I don't know where those went. Mm. Someone might have them somewhere.